A new ARPA policy report on climate change.
This report is not the entirety of what we propose as a Christian environmental policy. It's really assessing just the one aspect of the environmental policy that's popular currently, in particular at this time with the COP21 conference where the nations are coming together to talk about it. So it's dealing with environmental stewardship, economic stewardship, and ultimately care for the poor and needy. All of those things fall well underneath ARPA's mandate.
On the feature today, policy analyst Colin Postma with a response to some of the criticism the report has generated. In the news, Trinity Western University has won another legal round in its ongoing fight to open a law school in BC. Some new Canadian abortion statistics are out. We'll tell you why they really don't mean much. How should pro-lifers respond to those who disagree with them? An example today from a church youth group in Ontario. And assessing Donald Trump's call for a ban on Muslim immigration into the U.S.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
Trinity Western University in B.C. has won another round in its ongoing legal battles to establish a Christian law school. In April of last year, the Law Society of B.C. approved the establishment of the school, voting that graduates from there would be admitted to the bar in B.C. But in October, after concerns from some of its members, the Society revisited the issue and, based on a membership vote, decided to rescind that earlier approval. The university appealed that decision in B.C. Supreme Court, and last Thursday, Chief Justice Christopher Hinkson overturned the second decision. ARPA had intervened in that appeal, arguing the school's religious freedoms had been violated. But lawyer Andre Schutten says the decision didn't really touch very much on those arguments, looking instead at matters of due process.
The Law Society treated TWU unfairly. It did not allow TWU, for example, to include its defense of religious freedom in a mail-out that went to all of the members of the Law Society, whereas those opposed to Trinity Western were allowed to put their one or two pager in defense of their position against Trinity Western in that mail-out to the membership.
This is the third court ruling in this case. Schutten expects this decision will be appealed, and ultimately, he says, the issue could end up before the Supreme Court of Canada, which will have a lot of things to consider.
All three courts now, Nova Scotia, Ontario, and BC, have decided to rule on different nuances of the case. The Nova Scotia one is for sure my favorite, where the judge really got into the philosophical worldview questions, big, broad questions of freedom of religion. This one is a good decision too, but very focused on questions of procedural fairness, administrative law. And then the Ontario decision, the wrong decision in my opinion, focused very much on how, in their opinion, the law had changed and human rights law had changed, so now they could justify discrimination against a Christian law school in the name of quote-unquote human rights or equality rights.
The central issue in the case is TWU's so-called community covenant, in which both staff and students commit to the idea that sexuality can only find legitimate expression in heterosexual married relationships. The objections, of course, are that the covenant is a form of discrimination against those in homosexual relationships. The Canadian Institute for Health Information is out with some new abortion statistics. The numbers of hospital abortions across the country in calendar year 2014 was 33,931, down slightly from the 35,003 the year before. However, pro-life blogger Patricia Maloney says these numbers are far from complete.
Unfortunately, every year it's sort of the same thing. We don't have the abortions in doctors' offices, we don't have the chemical abortions, and all the data from the clinics is not complete because it's not mandatory for them to report. So how much is missing? We don't know.
She says this latest release again highlights the importance of the upcoming court challenge which ARPA is backing. A challenge to freedom of information laws which expressly exclude the reporting of full abortion statistics in several provinces like Ontario and BC. That case is expected to hit the courts sometime next year. How should pro-lifers respond to those who disagree with them? A church youth group in Ontario is providing a good example to the answer to that question. Last month, youth from the Ebenezer Canadian Reformed Church decided to put up a pro-life display in a farmer's field. 1,000 white crosses, each one representing 100 abortions done in Canada every year. They organized a work bee a few weeks back, tore down a bunch of pallets, painted them white, turned them into crosses, and planted them in the field. The display got some initial media attention and some negative responses on social media. Then, on the weekend of December 6th, somebody went into that field and knocked down all the crosses, destroyed some of them as well. So this past weekend, the kids, this time supported by at least one other church youth group from the area, went back into the field and put the crosses back up. Brooklyn Bergsma is with the sponsoring youth group. She says in the rebuild, they decided to expand the focus of the project.
We decided as a group that we definitely wanted to not direct it towards ourselves and wanting people to be like, oh, those poor teens, their display got ruined, like, poor them. We are not making it about how it has affected the teens, but how it affects the community and women who have abortions. So now we are collecting baby items for a women's help house in Chatham, and we are also collecting food for a food drive.
So the crosses are back up now. They hope to leave the display up through the rest of the winter. And finally, Donald Trump. The U.S. presidential candidate's been making huge waves south of the border with a promise that if he's elected president, he'll ban all Muslim immigration into his country. The idea has prompted outrage from his opponents, both in the Republican and Democratic races. However, Dr. Scott Masson, an associate professor at Tyndale University College in Toronto, says whether we like Trump or not, he's certainly pushing the debate on immigration within the American Christian community.
There are some Christians who are radically in favor of this non-judgmental, all-inclusive love, and that includes bringing people who we can't even tell whether they're enemies through our borders. And on the other hand, you got people who are seeing things, are alarmed about it, and want a discussion on it, and they're just not getting it. There's a great deal of confusion. Mr. Trump is certainly not the man who's going to dispel any confusion. He is a blunderbuss of a man. You know, he's blowing a hole in the debate, but he's sort of broken that Overton window that people talk about. Now we're talking about things that were unspeakable before.
Masson says there is a secondary issue on the immigration file that nobody's talking about.
Why aren't we hearing people pushing for, including the Christians and the Yazidis? And I think it's because you're actually specifying, in the case of the Christians, a group which our culture has decided cannot be oppressed. And even if they are being oppressed elsewhere, it would be judgmental of us to identify them specifically. And I think these people really need our help. So our foreign policy, if it's genuinely compassionate, we ought to be pushing the government to prioritize Christians and the Yazidis.
Back with more after this.
ARPA has a job opening for a web developer and e-activist. The successful candidate will be responsible for managing our websites and IT, as well as developing new tools for our supporters to be an effective salt and light. The full job description is available at arpacanada.ca. To apply, please submit a resume, cover letter, and references to Executive Director Mark Penninga at mark@arpacanada.ca.
And we're back on the program. With me on the line from the office in Ontario is Colin Postma, policy analyst with ARPA. Welcome to the program, Colin.
Thanks, Al.
Last week, ARPA released one of those respectfully submitted policy reports. This one dealt with climate change. First of all, Colin, give me a brief sort of summary of what the report says.
Sure, yeah. So the climate change report effectively was looking to outline a number of assumptions in the climate debate that we consider to be mistakes, as well as to address the policy implications and the validity of those assumptions. And then also looking at some of the concerns we have where there's this muzzling of credible scientific voices that are simply dissenting from the commonly held opinions. And then also put forward a mandate of creation stewardship that the Canadian government should adopt. So the end of the report also concludes with a series of recommendations for shaping environment policy. So those are the main things that we tried to hit on with this report.
This report has been well received in some quarters, not so well received in others. I've seen some discussion on social media. People are even asking the question, why is ARPA getting involved in this? I mean, isn't this more a science issue? Shouldn't we stick more to the social conservative stuff that we're known for, things like the pro-life cause and euthanasia and prostitution, stuff like that?
Well, ultimately, we think this is very much a part of ARPA's mission statement. Christian stewardship to the earth really is an important moral issue. And addressing the environment, proposing Christian environmental policy is well within ARPA's mandate. Now, it's important to point out that this report is not the entirety of what we propose as a Christian environmental policy. It's really assessing just the one aspect of the environmental policy that's popular currently, and particular at this time with the COP21 conference where the nations are coming together to talk about it. So it's dealing with environmental stewardship, economic stewardship, and ultimately a care for the poor and needy. All of those things fall well underneath ARPA's mandate.
Some of the other criticism I've seen, I mean, the weather's getting crazier all the time. You know, 2015's the hottest year on record. You should have used a more broad base of research. There's a fair bit of criticism out there, even from among ostensibly the ARPA support base, that looks at this report and says it doesn't line up with everything else we're hearing. That's essentially what I'm getting from some of that criticism.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, if you look at the sources that we used for this document, it comes from online databases, from the IPCC, from NOAA, from the United Nations, NASA, international think tanks, scientific journals, meteorological reports, books. So each of these sources, we've taken time to make sure that they're valid, that they're authentic, and the entire report was reviewed for statistical and scientific accuracy as well. So to say that we're not using sources from both sides of the argument simply isn't true. We're using the original sources from the government organizations that are putting forward these charges. Ultimately, part of the problem here is that we're trying to engage with what we understand to be an economic misunderstanding of the way that we should be moving forward to help people in poorer countries.
And that's the other part of the question. I mean, you know, I talked to Cal Beisner a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about this same issue in the context of David Suzuki and people who don't buy into climate change or like the folks who are advocating for slavery. And his point is that a lot of the policies that are being advocated at places like COP21 are actually harmful to the poor in the third world.
Yeah, I mean, last week's throne speech outlined the government's commitment to focus its development assistance on helping the world's poor and most vulnerable. And that's a good and honorable goal. But until a cost-competitive energy solution is developed, it's really hypocritical for Canada and the United Nations to require poor nations to use unreliable and expensive solar and wind power to generate energy, or to remain as they are in poverty using unhealthy and polluting fuels like dung, charcoal, garbage, that sort of thing. What really is needed here is abundant, reliable, affordable energy that scientists will say is at scale, instantly on demand, and unintermittent. Meaning, you know, wind and solar power have problems with those three things, and that's essential to lifting the poor out of poverty. So if we're looking at trying to help those in poorer countries to get out of poverty, why are we suggesting that, you know, a country like Kenya that's been given $40 billion on a loan to make changes to their energy system, why are we saying that the best way to help the poor is to give them solar and wind energy? It just doesn't make any sense. Ultimately, if people are to get out of poverty, effectively, they really do need fossil fuels, and that's the only way forward, unfortunately.
There's one particular quote from the report that really stood out for me, and it goes to some of the underlying assumptions about this, and that goes to the forecasts about the warming that's supposed to be happening. I'm going to read the quote, Colin. 95% of the IPCC's climate models predicted more warming than was observed, which implies that their errors are based on a bias incorporated into the models themselves. None of the models predicted the complete absence of statistically significant global warming, according to the satellite data, for over 18 years since January of 1997. Based on these failures, the models provide no rational basis for any predictions of future global average temperatures or any other climate-related phenomena, and therefore are not a sound basis for public policy. That's from the report. So what would be a sound basis for public policy in this area?
Well, current stats is the most important thing. I mean, we talk about even that 2015 was the hottest year on record. But really what they're meaning is that it's the hottest year since we started taking records, which is a very different thing. So it's important to look back in time at history and realize that climate, both carbon dioxide and heat and cooling, it's both been hotter and colder than it is today in the past. And also there's been more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than there is today in previous times in history. So the connection between carbon dioxide and temperature is not nearly what we think it is. And so the assumption that we should be predicting into the future based only on these models that have been proven to have errors in them and you know, hindcasting is what they call testing these things back in time. They constantly are overestimating these temperature trends. In fact, I think it was only 2 out of these reports that were actually somewhat accurate out of over 100 of these types of climate models.
We're out of time, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been Lighthouse News, delivering news and commentaries on today's current events to equip Christians for their task in the public square. Questions or feedback? You can leave us an audio comment by clicking on the answering machine button at the top of the Lighthouse News homepage, or you can send us an email, info@arpacanada.ca. Be sure to join us again next week for another edition of Lighthouse News.